And so Richard M. Nixon has announced that he will become the first president to resign his office. Beginning his speech, his voice broke slightly when he said, "In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation." His voice became stronger as he continued. He said he'd become convinced he no longer had the political base in the Congress to carry on. Without that base, he said, the constitutional process has been served and there was no need to carry through with the impeachment process, much as he would prefer to. And then came the words that will live in our history.
To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Mr. Nixon said, "I feel a great sadness. I will be not here in this office working on your behalf the next 2.5 years, but I know the leadership of America will be in good hands, those of now Vice President Ford." Mr. Nixon said, "By taking this action, I hope I will have hastened the start of that process of healing in America." Then came his only direct reference to the Watergate charges. "I would say only if some of my judgments were wrong, and some were wrong, they were made at the time in what I believe to be the best interests of the nation." Mr. Nixon said he's eternally grateful to those who stood with me. He leaves with no bitterness for those who opposed me. And much of the remainder of his address was devoted to his search for peace in his 5.5 years in office. Robert Pierpoint, are you there from the White House?
Neil, that was probably the most moving speech that Richard Nixon has ever made or ever will make. He was obviously moved himself, and yet, as he has said many times, in the period of a crisis, once the decision is made, then the tensions go, and you can proceed to do what has to be done. And that's what he demonstrated tonight. There were tensions, of course. His face twisted at times, and his voice broke as he said some of the words that were so hard for him to say. And nevertheless, he said them. There were some things that he did not say, of course. He did not in any way concede that he had committed any crimes. He did not even imply that he had himself done anything wrong, only that his judgments were wrong. And even then, he said, any judgments that were wrong were made in what he believed to be the best interests of the nation. But one probably could not have expected President Nixon at this stage to concede any wrongdoing. On the other hand, one might not have expected him to make as many fine points as he did make. He said he had no bitterness, and he showed none in this address tonight. Perhaps one of the most emotional moments came when he said he was never a quitter, and that what he was having to do was abhorrent to every instinct in his body. And at that point, he appeared to feel in every part of his body that abhorrence for what he was doing because he had to. It's very interesting to me that he laid this problem on the basis of Congress not being willing to give him political support. Obviously, the point at which he made the decision, and there's been much discussion about this in these last 2 or 3 days, but the point at which he made the decision was precipitated by the news brought to him yesterday afternoon by those three members of Congress from the Republican Party who came down to see him, Senator Scott, Senator Goldwater, and Congressman Rhodes. And I believe it was Senator Goldwater who pointed out to the president that if his case went to trial, if the impeachment was voted by the House and he was tried in the Senate, he could not expect more than 15 votes of support. That must have been the final blow to the president. And that, I believe, is why he said tonight there was no longer a political base in the Congress. And that's why he did what he was doing tonight. Now, one other important point, I think he went out, in a sense, with his flag flying when he enumerated the many things he's done in the field of foreign affairs. And I think that he believes, and he may very well be right, that history will view him somewhat differently than we do now because of his accomplishments in the field of foreign affairs. Altogether, Neil, it was a gracious farewell.
Bob, 8 presidents have previously died in office. This is the first one to announce he will resign. And yet, I suppose, in a way, you could say that this is the constitutional process of peaceful change at work as well.
Neil, I think that while there may be a great deal of sadness around the country at the moment, there are many people who did not want to see this moment ever come. At the same time, we must look at this as proof, living proof, that our Constitution works, that our democracy is a success, that the impeachment clause of the Constitution was written with good purpose, and it served its purpose. Now, it's true that the impeachment clause was not seen through to its end. There was no need for that. The president resigned rather than face conviction in the Senate. But the fact is that he would not have resigned had not the constitutional clause been there, which was being invoked. The process of peaceful change we have now proven is possible. And I think, in a sense, this is a very good thing for the country. After all, despite the very fine speech that he gave tonight, it has been proven to just about everyone's satisfaction that the president did more than make wrong judgments. The House Judiciary Committee, almost to a man, now believes he committed wrongs himself. And now the peaceful change is taking place in power. And that is a very, very important plus in a democracy as large and as diverse as ours, or in any nation as large and as powerful and as diverse as ours. Change is difficult, and it brings upheavals. In many cases, it brings danger and even worse. But in this case, in the United States, that is not happening. And I think that, frankly, I'm encouraged by seeing the process working the way it is.
Bob, we must remind ourselves what precipitated this resignation. Even though the House Judiciary Committee had completed work last week on 3 proposed articles of impeachment, it was the release this Monday of those 3 tapes made with H.R. Haldeman 6 days after the Watergate break-in that precipitated it, when those tapes show President Nixon talking of the political advantages of limiting the FBI investigation, which was at least delayed for a few days, although Mr. Nixon went on to point out that the FBI did complete its investigation shortly thereafter. But the question is raised, I think, by his speech. On Capitol Hill this day, a number of legislators worried about how to ensure that Mr. Nixon will not face prosecution after he leaves office. And Republican Senator Edward Brooke of Massachusetts introduced a sense of the Senate resolution which would urge immunity from Mr. Nixon. But even Brooke said that Mr. Nixon should make some kind of confession of error.
When I introduced the resolution on immunity for the president today, I said that I would want full confession from the president of his involvement in Watergate and all related incidents. I think the American people are entitled to know all of the facts, and I think the president must make a clean breast of it. And when he does resign from office, I would agree that he certainly should not say that I'm resigning, but I'm not guilty of any offense.
There's a fear on the part of some Democrats, and I should say some Republicans too, that if there isn't some statement of what they feel is the record on Watergate made plain, and that obviously now will not be made plain through an impeachment proceeding, perhaps through reports of the Judiciary Committee and so forth, but if that isn't made plain, that in time some fear that The opinion will be that the president was hounded out of office by the news media and by partisan people, and that the case will not become known to history.
Neil, there is that fear, you're right, but on the other hand, it seems to me that anyone who has the opportunity to read the record, that is to get a look at the transcripts, to see what the House Judiciary Committee did, saw, and heard, you know, the facts are there, and those men were in the beginning not at all anxious to have Mr. Nixon impeached, and after they went through the facts carefully, they made the unhappy decision that he had to be impeached, and finally all 38 of them agreed with that. So that there are going to be people in this country who would not care what the facts were, would not be interested in hearing about the facts. They don't want impeachment of a president. They don't want the resignation of Richard Nixon under any circumstances.
But, Bob, we, of course, now have the resignation impending, at least as of noon tomorrow, of the president, with Gerald Ford to become the 38th president of the United States. And to help us along with observations on these momentous events, let's bring in from New York correspondents Reed Collins and Charles Osgood.
Well, Charles, you and I sat here and we listened to it, as did our colleagues in Washington. The speech clocks out to about 15 minutes and 15 seconds. I noted that I believe an elocutionist would have appreciated the delivery, hardly a slip, maybe one about 9.5 minutes deep on the Soviet Union. But it was a speech unlike, I think, some of Mr. Nixon's previous addresses that tended to run past the optimum length. Probably about right, if there is a standard for this kind of thing, which is unique in itself, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Reed. And I think that, as our colleagues in Washington have pointed out, that this may be the most moving speech that President Nixon has ever made or will ever make. It was moving. It was a statesmanlike kind of a speech. It showed no bitterness and no rancor whatever to his political enemies. There was none of the Richard Nixon of 1960. No Nixon to kick around anymore. Nothing of that sort.
I thought if you really wanted to hear the nub of it, the first 60 seconds got it done. He said he thought he had the duty to persevere, to complete the term of office. But within the first minute, he had said that this was impossible because, in a lawyer's legalistic sense, his political base had disappeared. He did not put his neck in the noose that Senator Brooke had suggested, with the implied promise that the Senate somehow would then take it back out for him or destroy the noose, which I think most lawyers would have been reluctant to do, leaving the office and not knowing what grand juries in Washington, D.C. might decide to do, or what individuals who felt they had some legal shows in action might decide to do. That full confession idea probably would not sit well with anybody who had any legal background.
Reed, I believe that many Americans may be wondering, well, what happens now? The president is going to San Clemente tomorrow. He's not going to be at the White House to attend the ceremony for the swearing-in of Gerald Ford as the 38th president. There is, we understand, a brief ceremony planned tomorrow. It's going to be private, at which the president will say goodbye to his White House staff. And then he'll be getting on a helicopter, and he'll be going over to Andrews Air Force Base and flying from there to California. At some point during that flight, he will cease to become president, because the 38th president will be sworn in while he's en route, and when he gets off the plane in California, he'll be Richard Nixon, private citizen.
I imagine the temptation to look at one's watch around noontime Eastern Daylight Time will be pretty strong as the president and his family fly west. Well, despite the resignation, details of which we have just heard, and the fact of it, we have heard that the president still faces some legal difficulties, as we have sort of hashed about here, and CBS correspondent Fred Graham takes a closer look at some of those problems.
He's got a lot of legal problems. It's unprecedented, of course, for a president to get in legal difficulty in the first place. We've never had one that's had these problems, and it was rather unnatural what happened, because Richard Nixon had the immunity of the office. He couldn't be prosecuted. He couldn't be sued. He couldn't be called as a witness personally. He, of course, was subpoenaed for papers. All that's stripped away now. He can now be subpoenaed to testify in person. There will be an effort to disbar him. State and local prosecutors could attempt to name him as a defendant in some of these cases, although I doubt that would happen. And he can be sued. Daniel Ellsberg at one time talked about the possibility of suing the president because of the burglary of his psychiatrist's office. There was some talk that some of these people who were illegally wiretapped might name the president. They didn't while he was president. They could add him now as a defendant. So he could become enmeshed in a whole web of legal difficulties that could make his life very unpleasant for years to come.
Well, as Fred points out, Charles, he could be sued. From what we read and hear, Mr. Nixon is almost judgment-proof, however, owing the amounts of money that he does in some pyramided mortgages. I believe he hasn't met the last one completely on San Clemente. And so all of these things are, of course, one of those legal entanglements, and many people, I think, for reasons of a variety, probably might like to take that course of legal action. But Mr. Nixon, I think, stands to have some income. Our colleagues in Washington, I think, know a little more about this, but theoretically this will save the $60,000 annual ex-presidential pension. I believe there's another $96,000 involved, is there not, in running the office? And then maybe some other pension money that will pile on top of that. The civil service commission will have to decide what an ex-vice president, congressman, and senator has accrued. Is anybody there familiar with that, Neil, or Robert?
Yes.
Address myself to that, Reed. The fact is, you're quite correct. First of all, under the present laws, the president is eligible for $60,000 a year in pension, at least $96,000 a year in expenses for staff and stationery and equipment and that kind of thing, and that does not include office space. He'll get that for free. He has a $20,000 a year pension for Mrs. Nixon when he passes on as a widow's pension for all former president's wives. And in addition to that, I think it's fair to point out that he also has very valuable property. Now, it's true that at the moment he is a little cash poor. That is, if he sells his land in San Clemente or any parts thereof, and I think he could sell some of the land around the mansion without selling the mansion itself, that is very valuable land. Several acres of it there. He may not be able to do that because of the local restrictions, but he does not have to keep that San Clemente mansion. It is worth, I would estimate, well over $1 million. Secondly, he has $500,000 at least in property down in Key Biscayne. So that, and now, mind you, he would have lost the income from pensions and from the emoluments of being an ex-president if he had been convicted and removed from office. He still would have had the property. But all of this taken together, he's not going to come out of this a poor man, and I don't think that we ought to push that point too far. And I doubt very seriously that courts are going to judge him guilty in the sense that he's going to have to pay out a lot of money in lawsuits. I doubt very seriously that that's going to happen. I think the real problem the president faces is the one of criminal prosecution. And we've discussed this at some length. Fred gave you some interesting views on it a little while ago, but there's one other thing I'd like to point out, and that is, in talking to Fred and others, it seems the simplest way for the president to be freed of criminal prosecution is for President Ford, when he takes office, to grant a pardon for all crimes the president may have committed. And he doesn't even have to be brought before any courts to have that pardon given to him across the board. Now, this is a little difficult for Ford because one time he was asked this very question when he was being heard before the Senate Judiciary Committee. What would happen if you became president and Mr. Nixon was convicted of crimes? Would you pardon him? And he said something about, well, I don't think the American public would stand for that. Now, however, the vice president, who will soon be president, is faced with just that kind of problem. And what it seems to me may happen is that the Congress of the United States could vote a resolution of immunity which has no legal force, but which would be a sense of the Congress that he should be pardoned. And in that case, the Congress, speaking as the representatives of the people, could in effect say to the President, President Ford, we think that the people want the President pardoned. That is probably the best and simplest way that he can escape any possible future criminal prosecution.
Reed and Charles and Bob, we should note that just about 15 minutes before Mr. Nixon went on the air, the White House issued a set of the last official photographs taken of the first family. And one of them showed President Nixon holding his daughter, Julie Eisenhower, as she's overcome with sobs on the eve of his resignation from the presidency. The pictures were taken by the official White House photographer, Ollie Atkins. And, of course, those were highly emotional moments. The president, we were told, was serene this last day, and he certainly was in his speech, but his family was quite overcome at his decision to leave the presidency. And now the man who's to assume the presidency is outside his house. We go to Leslie Stahl.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States. I think that this is one of the most difficult and very saddest periods, and one of the very saddest incidences I've ever witnessed. Let me say that I think the President of the United States has made one of the greatest personal sacrifices for the country and one of the finest personal decisions on behalf of all of us as Americans by his decision to resign as President of the United States. It's been my opportunity to watch over a period of nearly 25 years a foreign policy in the last 5 years that has been most successful in the achievement of peace for all of us here and hopefully the rest of the world. It's been a policy that I think can continue peace in the months and years ahead. Let me say without any hesitation or reservation that the policy that has achieved peace and built the blocks for future peace will be continued, as far as I'm concerned, as President of the United States. We've been fortunate in the last 5 years to have a very great man in Henry Kissinger, who has helped to build the blocks of peace under President Nixon. I think those policies should be continued. And those policies of peace will be continued. I have asked Henry Kissinger, as Secretary of State, to stay on and to be the Secretary of State under the new administration. I've known Henry Kissinger for a great many years. I knew him before he came with the Nixon administration. I want him to be my Secretary of State, and I'm glad to announce that he will be the Secretary of State. Which means that he and I will be working together in the pursuit of peace in the future as we have achieved it in the past. We have many other problems. We have problems at home which must be resolved. and they can be resolved and will be resolved by the cooperation of the Congress with the President and those that work with him. I've been very fortunate in my lifetime in public office to have a good many adversaries in the political arena in the Congress. But I don't think I have a single enemy in the Congress. And the net result is that I think tomorrow I can start out working with Democrats and with Republicans in the House as well as in the Senate to work on the problems, serious ones, which we have at home. And the spirit of cooperation, which I believe will be exhibited with the Congress and the new president on the problems overseas and the problems at home, will be beneficial not only to 211 fine million Americans, but to the world as a whole. And I pledge to you tonight, as I will pledge tomorrow and in the future, my best in cooperation, leadership, and dedication to what's good for America and good for the world. Thank you very much.
So Gerald Ford, about to become the 38th President of the United States, has already taken an important step in what will be the Ford administration, the announcement reassuring, we're sure, to nations abroad that Secretary of State Henry Kissinger will stay on and they will work together for the cause of peace. Leslie Stahl, you're there outside the Vice President's house in Alexandria, Virginia. You carry on. Leslie Stahl, can you hear me? Well, the miracles of the broadcast media seem to have ceased at this point. We did bring you in by the Vice President, Gerald Ford, with his informal remarks outside his house in Alexandria. We are getting many other comments now as these moments after the President's speech, and one from a very important key figure in this entire process of these past few days, the Republican leader of the House, John Rhodes of Arizona. It was Rhodes, you'll remember, after the disclosures on Monday, who said he thought the president should resign, who went to the White House last night with two other Republican leaders and told the president of the mood of the Congress. And now from Rhodes tonight, these comments.
The president of the United States, I think, showed himself to be a true champion as he ended his career as president of the United States. I think he was doing his very best to bring the country back together. He admitted that he had made mistakes. He also said that he had no rancor toward anybody. He thanked those who supported him and said to those who didn't that he understood. I really don't see how it could have been a better speech for the future of the United States of America and for the beginning of a new administration.
Mr. Rhodes, you've been coming up and sitting in that chair as long as I can remember and sitting beside Gerry Ford, and you know him as well as anyone. Would you please tell the American people what sort of man their new president is?
Well, I wish I had more time, but suffice it to say, Gerry Ford is many things. He's a good man. He's a man who believes in God. He's a man who believes in himself and his friends. He's a man with high moral standards. And he's a man who has a burning desire to make this country the greatest country possible. He's a man who wants peace in the world. He's a man who wants the best life possible for every one of the American people. And I think he'll make a great president.
And so there, Reed Collins and Charles Osgood, you have the transition, the comments of the Republican leader of the House, John Rhodes, on the speech by the outgoing president and his comments on the incoming president.
And we shall be staying with the presidential resignation story into this evening. We'll be updating it, reporting new developments in reaction to it, and, of course, to the incoming president.
We'll be profiling both Mr. Nixon and Mr. Ford and looking at the future for both men as it appears from this vantage point. Our bureaus and CBS stations around the country will give the reactions of your fellow citizens to the momentous events before us. And CBS News Abroad will tell us about the reaction around the world. And in Washington, Neil Strausser, you'll be remaining on deck and on top of all the developments there at the White House and Congress or wherever, as they happen with the aid of our CBS News correspondents at every key point in the Capitol for our continuing coverage of the resignation of President Nixon. I'm Charles Osgood with Reed Collins. One comment that has come forward tonight is from Special Watergate Prosecutor Leon Jaworski, who says that no agreement or understanding has been made between the president and the special prosecutor. He says that the president asked for no special arrangement and none was offered to him. Of course, this is a matter of some interest because it means that the prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, is free to proceed, at least he is as of this hour, with any prosecutions against the president. Once the resignation takes effect tomorrow at noon, Jaworski did not say tonight one way or the other whether that is his intention.
No, I think, Charles, he felt it incumbent, though, to answer at least some of the questions, at least to negate some of the possibilities that have been bruited about. To recap, within the past 50 minutes in these United States, one president, the 37th, noting that he had spoken 37 times from the Oval Office to the people, told all those people that he's quitting as of noon tomorrow, saying he would like to have completed the term, felt that his political base in Congress obviously had eroded to the point where he simply could not, and therefore Mr. Nixon said he's stepping down. And Vice President Ford is in that same Oval Office at noon tomorrow to take the oath of office. We still don't know precisely legally and constitutionally, Charles, when the president becomes the former president and when Mr. Ford becomes the president, for the simple reason that this transaction is supposed to take place when a letter reaches the Secretary of State, as in his hands, notifying him that the current president no longer wishes to be so.
We haven't seen, of course, the instrument of resignation as yet, which, as you say, is a letter to the Secretary of State.
Well, Henry Kissinger has one of those. He got one about 10 months back, I believe, from Vice President Agnew. So this will be the second sort of thing brought, presumably hand-delivered, tomorrow sometime.
I would imagine that either will be delivered at the stroke of noon or the reference to time will be contained in the letter that as of 12 noon on the 10th of August, I, Richard Nixon, resigned my office as President of the United States.
Reed and Charles, the legal opinion at the State Department when this unprecedented situation was that at the time the letter, if it did not set a time of resignation, but simply resigned immediately, at the time the letter reached the Secretary of State's office, not even his own hands. The presidency changed hands at that point. But this situation is unprecedented, and this time, for the first time, we have the kind of letter that presumably will state a time when he leaves office. So it probably doesn't matter when it's delivered to the Secretary of State as long as it reaches him by noon Eastern Daylight Time tomorrow.
Well, Neil, you know, the man with whom Mr. Nixon has had a great deal of correspondence and through which he fought one unsuccessful reach for the presidency, listened along with everybody else this evening to that 15-minute, 15-second resignation address. I speak, of course, of Mr. Nixon's one-time running mate, Henry Cabot Lodge, who feels the president has presented himself in good form.
The tone was very good. There isn't any doubt that the events which brought about his departure are tragic and saddening for all of us. But it's also true that he leaves behind him accomplishment in the field of foreign affairs, which I think is very real. The Constitution has worked well. It has enabled us to handle this problem, which in many countries leads to violence, and which in this country, thanks to the Constitution and thanks to our ability to use it, have brought about an orderly change.
Lodge, the former ambassador to the United Nations, also had some high praise for Gerald Ford, calling the next president stable and able, Charles.
Members of Gerald Ford's family watched President Nixon's speech tonight in Grand Rapids, Michigan. CBS News correspondent Ike Pappas asked the vice president's brother, Tom Ford, how he feels now that Gerald Ford will be assuming the office of president tomorrow.
It's frightening. It's frightening because if the public doesn't get behind and get off the negative thinking, we're going to continue to drift. And I'm positive of Jerry's ability to lead if we'll get off negativism and get on some positive things about what's good. And I think Jerry can get along that line if the public will answer with their prayers and their help.